Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Professor Kirk Hansen, Executive Director of the Markulis Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University and your moderator for this program. This program is part of the Commonwealth Club's series in Ethics and Accountability, underwritten by the Charles Travers family. Tonight, we will have a discussion of the political climate in California and in the nation. Our program is entitled, Must Politics Be a Dirty Business? Pundits and politicians alike have expressed concern about the poisonous atmosphere already apparent in the 2012 election season. Some fear it will only get worse in the remaining months until Election Day. They decry the strident and even vitriolic language of campaigns, growing ethics charges by candidates against one another, out-of-control process where independent expenditures have exploded. Some fear this will turn off the public to the point where participation itself in the electoral process will diminish. How bad has politics gotten at both the state and national levels? What steps can improve and further democratize the election process? Today, the head of the California Fair Political Practices Commission, a prominent former elected official and the former Democratic chief of staff to a Republican governor, will discuss whether political campaigns can be ethical, and whether ethics and politics are mutually exclusive. Let me introduce our distinguished panelists. Next to me is Ann Ravel, who was appointed by Governor Jerry Brown as chair of the California Fair Political Practices Commission in February 2011 to a term that expires in January 2015. The commission was established by the Political Reform Act of 1974 and is a nonpartisan body of five members charged with establishing and enforcing rules governing campaign financing and spending, financial conflicts of interest, lobbying registration and reporting, revolving door employment rules, mass mailings by elected officials, and gifts and honoraria to public officials and candidates. Prior to arriving at the commission, Chair Ravel was Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Torts and Consumer Litigation in the Civil Division of the United States Department of Justice. She also served as County Counsel for Santa Clara County. Chair Ravel previously served on the Judicial Council of California, the Board of Governors of the State Bar, and the Hispanic National Bar Association. She recently promoted and enacted political donations by text messaging and has been seeking other ways to democratize the election process. Bill Jones has served four governors and four U.S. presidents. A second-generation California rancher, Mr. Jones was first elected California Secretary of State in 1994 and was reelected in 1998. He was praised for his even-handed approach in implementing innovative programs to increase voter participation and to place all campaign contributions and spending information on the Internet. Among his notable accomplishments were the state's first-ever election summit to help guarantee a fraud-free voting system, a special unit to investigate and help prosecute people who commit voter fraud, and the implementation of strict penalties for candidates and lobbyists who fail to meet important disclosure requirements. Before his election as Secretary of State, Mr. Jones served 12 years in the California State Assembly, where he also served as the Republican leader. Mr. Jones is currently founder and chairman of the board of Pacific Ethanol, a company involved in the production of renewable fuel. Susan Kennedy has more than two decades of frontline experience in political campaigns. She has served two California governors as chief of staff to Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger and as cabinet secretary and deputy chief of staff to Democrat Gray Davis. She has been credited with creating efficiency in Governor Schwarzenegger's campaign efforts and for her role in boosting the governor's fundraising. Ms. Kennedy previously served as communications director for U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein and as executive director of the California Democratic Party. She is now a private consultant and senior advisor with the law firm Alston & Byrd, and she sits on the powerful five-member health benefits exchange tasked with implementing federal health care reform in California. Please welcome all of our panelists. I'm going to ask each of the panelists an opening question, and then we'll proceed on with your questions. Ann Ravel, as head of the FPPC currently, what worries you about this year's campaign season? Do you think we're about to embark on a period of even more negative campaigning and more influence by money?
First, I want to thank everybody for coming tonight, and it's really a pleasure to be here at the Commonwealth Club to talk about what's a really timely, important topic. Your question, Kirk, is are we going to see more negative campaigning and more money in politics? I don't think there's any question that we will be seeing a lot more money in politics and probably lots of violations of the law as well. But if I could go on a little bit, I think the bigger question tonight that's being asked is, must politics be a dirty business? And it's ironic, but Richard Nixon, who, of course, was the architect of the Watergate scandal and the reason why the Political Reform Act was enacted in 1974, has said, I reject the cynical view that politics is a dirty business. So, you know, even though we're going to see a torrent of negative ads, as we have seen already in the presidential primaries, and we also from time to time have seen a lot of scandals in California and elsewhere, I don't think that politics is a dirty business. I hate to get to the, you know, bottom line so soon, but the Political Reform Act really was enacted to increase public trust in government. And one of the big questions is that we can talk about tonight is whether some of the rules that you referred to have really had that impact, given that it's been 40 years and we still see so much negativity and so many issues. Clearly, what I see for the next election are three things that, you know, I'd like to address, and I'm sure there are lots of other things that we're going to address. But one of them is, of course, the rise of super PACs and what that has done to politics on the national level and what the impact will be in California, although California has always, or for a long time, permitted independent expenditures. The second thing that I think will hopefully increase public sort of sense that politics isn't a dirty business is if there is more disclosure, more transparency. And I know everybody talks about transparency, and unfortunately we don't have a very robust system for giving information to the public, and I think that's something we need to change. And then finally, you know, as the chair of the FPPC, I have to say that I think the FPPC has participated itself in some of the sort of negative views of government and negative views of politics by emphasizing small issues, small transgressions, and identifying them as if they are ethical violations rather than actually going after big issues.
And we'll get to that. Let me turn to Bill. So, it's Bill Jones. It's been a number of years since you had some of the responsibility for the voting process as Secretary of State. How have things changed, and what worries you this year?
Well, I want to thank the Commonwealth Club. My wife Maureen and I have been here before, and we're pleased to be back. Thank you. And I think the whole issue of politics in general, this whole question of the intensity or the negative campaigning is not new. You can go back all the way to Abraham Lincoln. You can go back further than that. What is new is the intensity of the media coverage. So with a 24-hour cycle, it makes everything heightened, and you see it repeatedly, whereas when I started in public life, there were three television stations, and you get a direct mail piece, and that was the campaign and some 4x8s on the highways. Today, you can't get away from it. And so politics has turned into ratings, and that means there's money in it for the stations and for the media, which in turn puts all the candidates in an environment that, while they always were interested in publicity, now it is that they are a vehicle for the ratings. And if you know anything about TV ratings, you know, if you're going to do a talk show, they don't want you to come on and agree. They want you to come on and fight. And so they set the tenor there that creates an awful lot of controversy, which then in turn is, you know, magnified and goes out to the public. And so it isn't that even the issues, I think, have changed as much. But as you just mentioned a moment ago, we've always had independent expenditures in California. They have to be reported. When I was Secretary of State, when we started, we just had paper. If you wanted to come in and see what anybody gave, we gave you paper. You moved on to technology. Now you're moving on, as you said, and I compliment you for your effort. But no matter how much disclosure you do, as long as the politics and this 24-hour news cycle is competitive among the different networks and whatnot, it is going to create a different dynamic that is spun up and heightened. And it requires, if you want to compete in that, money to do it. So you're always going to have money in politics. I believe strongly that disclosure is the key. The better disclosure you can get, the better off you are. I do believe that the super PAC should be disclosing. I don't think that's appropriate not to disclose. And then let the process continue as it might. But I think one thing about this year, at least in our primaries for president, it is amazing that someone like a Rick Santorum can do what he's done with hard work and knocking on doors, and I, you know, and overcome this media. And part of the reason that's true is because of the debates. And I think public discussion, public debates, I used to hate them when I did them. I did three when I was running for governor and one for the U.S. Senate, and they're not fun. They're not fun for the participants to get ready for them. They're very tough. But it's very good for the public because it's unfiltered. You can turn it on or you can turn it off. You can make your own decision, and you don't have to wait for someone to pay for that notice. So disclosure, debates, and I think when you get right down to the question of the dirty politics, politics any different than anything else, you have to know the people that are running, and you have to elect people that have good character and have an interest in serving the public, and then you will get a better quality of government. But the intensity of the process is going to continue as long as the media is there.
Susan Kennedy, let me ask, to some extent, you're a symbol of bipartisanship as a Democrat working for a Republican governor. On the other hand, you're a symbol of someone who tries to be bipartisan and gets attacked from both sides. Is the atmosphere as vitriolic in state government day-to-day as it seems to be in the campaign process that that Ann Ravel and Bill were talking about?
Oh, simple answer is yes. Politics is a dirty business. Campaigns, whether you live in a democracy or a dictatorship, politics is a dirty business. It's the intersection between power, money, and human beings. You're going to have problems. Campaigns are a blood sport. They are. We need strong referees to, like the FPPC, in order to keep cheating to a minimum. but it is as much entertainment, as Bill said, and as it is an important part of our democratic process because we choose our elected officials that way. But I think the most important thing is it's not more poisonous today. I totally agree with what Bill said. It's not more poisonous today or more vitriolic today than it was. If Twitter had existed in the early 1800s, half our founding fathers would have been run out of town on the rim and never elected to office. But, I mean, the accusations are no different. The vitriol is no different today than it has been since the founding of our country. What has changed is we're in a period of permanent campaigning. I think it's governing itself that has become poisonous. People are frustrated because they elect people to office on a series of campaign promises that they hear year after year after year. But then when people get to where they're going, whether it's Sacramento or the city council or the White House or Congress, they don't see change. They don't see people dealing with problems. What has changed is that we've lost. We don't elect statesmen such as Bill Jones to office anymore. And I'm not just blowing smoke because he's sitting next to me. He is truly considered one of the last statesmen that in California politics in the era where we solved big problems. We're electing people to office now with a very myopic view of their time in office and a necessarily selfish and limited view because they're always running for the next office. We've created that dynamic. And so I think the poison has entered the governing process much more so than the campaigns.
And if both because of the media exposure and the governing process, we have this kind of sense of the public's frustration, is there any way to relieve that? Can they get to the point where they don't expect Bill Jones to make 99 promises, and then hold him to account on satisfying every one of those?
I think the people that run have to hold themselves to account. When we ran for Secretary of State, we made a list of 10 or 15 things that we committed to do, and we proceeded to check off the boxes as we went through 8 years. Mm-hmm. And when we finished, I think we had, and this was with a Democrat governor, Gray Davis was governor at the end, and the legislature was Democratic, both houses. But I had served with a lot of the Democrats in the legislature, so even if I got into a disagreement with the governor, oftentimes the members that I had served with that were in chairmanships of committees would help me achieve what if they believed it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I think it has to be a willingness to step out in the middle. I think... what you were able to do serving a Republican governor, Democrat governor, you know, it is important. What happens is you get fire from both sides. And it is not an easy situation because today one of the problems you have is everything is either right or left. It's either black or white. And the truth is that if the problems of a state like California, we had very similar problems in 92 that Jerry Brown, Governor Brown, has today. And we worked through those issues, and we ended up not taking it to the ballot. But it was very difficult. And so if you can't step out into that gray area in the middle and try and find a solution, it is very difficult to achieve any success, whether it be in the area of political reform or just general policy. And it's hard to do that today.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that, while I agree with some of what you've said, one of the reasons why the public is so disenchanted with their elected officials is not just because of the complications of term limits and the like. I think from what our perspective has been at the FPPC, you see that there is so much influence of big money and big corporate interests. And it's not, I mean, there has to be money in campaigns. I understand people have to run campaigns and it costs a lot of money because of the news cycle. But it makes people think that they shouldn't even participate in government and they shouldn't even be engaged because there's of the outsized influence that people with a lot of money have over their elected officials, which I think is really problematic. for this.
I have to disagree with part of it, because I don't know how you single out the money and influence of big corporations when you have unions that have a lot of working people, firefighters, teachers. These are not big corporations, but they've banded together to be some of the most powerful, influential forces in state government. And you've got some associations that don't have any, they don't contribute any money, but their reputation, if they've taken on an issue like Caltax, the Howard Jarvis, I mean, they're not a big moneyed corporation, yet they have some of the largest influence in Sacramento or in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Just because if they say yes or no in terms of a tax issue, elected officials will run in fear.
One of the questions asks about interest groups and the trend towards getting pledges, whether it be the anti-tax pledge or other pledges, to support particular positions. Is that a problem that creates some of the stridency in our politics today?
We had pledges, those same type of pledges, when I was in the legislature. People would, when you run for office, you get questionnaires from everybody. And every group wants you to fill out a questionnaire, answer every possible question they could have, and then hold you accountable to all those answers 4 years later when you're serving and you're voting on these different bills. And those questionnaires are very difficult. And for the most part, I would avoid filling them out, period. And it creates problems when you're running, because that will put you on a list, and all of a sudden you're getting mail that says you're not this or you're not that. However, the best way to be able to serve is to be able to know your district so well and fit your district so that you can vote your conscience, and it, for the most part, will align with your district. It's not going to align 100%, but people are willing to allow you mistakes or differences as long as they know that you have their interest at heart and that you, for the most part, are in sync with their philosophy. And I don't think I could represent San Francisco in the legislature, because my views on a host of issues would not be in sync with a lot of people in San Francisco. But by the same token, I don't think...
We wouldn't even send you the questionnaire.
I think you're probably right. I think probably Speaker Brown would have a hard time when he was Speaker coming down in Fresno and representing Fresno. But it makes life much easier on the elected member if they know their district and they can sit on the floor, they can cast their votes, and they can really represent their people. And I've seen members who run answering questionnaires, don't believe what they're saying in campaigns, go to the Sacramento, sit on the floor, and are tortured by the votes they can't cast. And what happens is you see people that they vote present, or they abstain, or whatever. So you've got to start off from a fundamental position where you know your district, and they know you, and the rest of it kind of works itself out.
But it's also hard. For someone who's already elected to office, you can sort of distance yourself from that and withstand that. But if you're running for office for the first time and you're in a crowded primary, you need those endorsements in order to differentiate yourself. You can't get elected, or you can't get the PAC contributions that help you run. So they get caught having to pledge things in order to get the support, in order to make it through
the primary. It's very hard. You're right.
There are two questions about asking you to define dirty politics. And where's the line between fair, tough, negative politics and dirty politics? Which one of you would like to take that on? Susan?
Truth and untruth.
That's a fair answer.
So any accusation that is true is fair game?
Yes.
I think campaigns are about vetting candidates. If you don't want to be vetted, you better not get in the game. And I think Susan's statement on that is probably as close to concise answer to your question as you can get.
There's things that are off, I think, still off limits. Those lines get blurred. How you treat family members, mm-hmm. how you treat, personal issues. But if it's true, it's fair game.
I would agree.
Let me come back to another subject of several of the questions already, which is, of course, money in politics and the Citizens United decision and what it has produced. Is Citizens United as bad as some of the critics said And is it creating much of the problem today, or has it been more benign as an influence on our campaigning process?
I think Citizens United has, what it's done is not just unleash a flood of money, which of course is, as we've all talked about, is part of campaigning, but it's often unleashed anonymous money. And what has happened with that has increased the ability of people to engage in vitriol. And though, while I agree, that kind of behavior has always existed in politics, and maybe some of what's occurred has exacerbated because of the media. But frankly, I think Citizens United has also increased the ability for people who don't have the responsibility to disclose who they are, or because they're independent, allegedly, they can say things that the candidates themselves wouldn't ever be able to say publicly. And that has created, I think, a lot of the negativity.
I think Ann's right. And if you can't go at the end of a spot and put your face on it and say, I paid for this, then you set a different bar. And disclosure is necessary, and it is the best antiseptic for dirty campaigning. And I think it's patently ridiculous that candidates are able to sit there and run their own, and then they have an independent over here and say they don't have, you know, and totally be able to set it aside and not take responsibility. It needs to be disclosed, and to the extent possible, the candidate needs to take responsibility for that independent, if possible.
Yeah, I think the best thing was John Stewart, when he was talking about Stephen Colbert's association, said, yes, these super PACs don't coordinate except by telephone and by email.
Yeah. Susan?
I don't think you can say that it created the problem. We were complaining about the 527 committees before that. We were complaining about the independent expenditures before that. We've always complained about the independent third-party expenditures in campaigns. But the anonymity of it, I think, that has gotten somewhat worse. But that's a very, very difficult problem to deal with. But I think the only tools we have revolve around transparency.
Transparency, but we're never going to stem the flow of money.
Never.
Well, and I happen to believe that money is speech. People have a right to contribute. And it is a problem, but when they get so big, whether it be the unions or others, they get so big that they consume the process. So all that is true. However, what you find is that if you go back and look at the initiatives that have been passed in California, and oftentimes even some of the candidates that have won, it isn't always the candidate that's got the most money that wins, and many initiatives that were very well funded lost because the public actually perceived they had an opinion on it. So it isn't always just the money. It is the disclosure, because oftentimes, the public is more sophisticated when it gets down to the last month than you think. And if I run an ad for my campaign and I have to put my name on it and have my face at the end, you better believe I look at what that's saying. If you don't have that connection, it is totally different. And that is where this separation has come, and now you've got this independent, as we've had in California, but this super PAC, and it's had a dramatic impact. So I think you need to have the disclosure, and you need to have the name of the candidate, if possible. However, I think freedom of speech is, in fact, important, and it's always going to take, especially in states like California, money to get your message out.
Now, there's some questions about independent expenditures and the ability of the candidate to control what is said. And one of the questions says, isn't it inevitable that if you have a, quote, independent committee that does not have to be signed off by the candidate, you're going to have a looser standard of truth and fairness?
Probably so.
Well, but you're conflating the candidate's control over the message with their the standards here. If there's an independent committee that's doing the speaking, they could either be helping or hurting the candidate. I mean, if Rush Limbaugh was his own super PAC right now, I think the Republicans would pass a law tomorrow to curtail super PACs.
Yeah.
I actually ran a couple of campaigns that were separate from the candidate. It's not rocket science to run a campaign and follow your candidate's message without coordinating with the campaign. It's actually pretty easy to do. So it's, and whether or not you help or hurt, you know, sometimes they don't necessarily help their candidate with their cause.
Yeah, I agree with Susan. I think that there are a lot of, we think of the super PACs on the national level, but in California, as I said, there have been a lot of independent expenditures since 2000. And many of the independent expenditure committees have actually hurt candidates on the local level because of their mm-hmm. campaigns. But the truth is, in what we've seen, at least on the federal level, that association is so close. And the FEC is doing nothing to deal with that problem. And they've been able to control, in many ways, those independent expenditure committees, control what the candidates actually say, even in some of those wonderful debates.
Let's explore the disclosure of campaign contributions, because I know mm-hmm. that's been a concern of
right.
yours at the FPPC.
Huge.
It was a concern of Bill's during right. his time as Secretary of State. What do you all feel is the optimal system of disclosure? Do I fax in the check to my campaign account and simultaneously it shows up on the Internet with all of the data? Is this a half-hour responsiveness? Should we know today what contributions came in today?
I don't think it's practical to have daily disclosure. It would be overwhelming. I mean, I think what's important in disclosure is the kind of information that the public actually needs to be making thoughtful decisions about candidates or initiatives. The law in California, at least for most campaigns, is 90 days in advance of the election, then it's 24 hours. And I think that's a good, that's only for state, not for local, though. Mm-hmm. Needs to be equalized. I don't think that's bad. I think part of the problem is we can't capture everybody. And that's one of the things that we can't capture all of the super PACs, all of the people in some of these nonprofits who are contributing to organizations that are actually putting the money in California campaigns.
Why not? But, you can write the rules, can't you,
well,
as the FPPC?
Well, no, the legislature writes the rules, but we'd like to have that happen. But certainly disclosure is extremely important.
I think if they have time to deposit the check, they have time to post it on the web. I think the more we have tried to limit campaign contributions, the more we've fostered the development of these third-party committees. I would rather see a candidate take responsibility for every dollar they raise. I don't care how big the check is. I'd rather have they own the contributors to their campaign and it be disclosed instantly than to have this system where we limit. You have mayor's races running in California right now with $500 limits. You're creating the atmosphere where these third-party committees are forced to and want to play, but you're giving them the power by doing so.
Mm-hmm. By having limits that are too tight.
And they're ineffective. I mean, it'd be one thing if it was effective. It's not effective. It limits people's contributions, and so therefore they contribute to these third-party PACs, which are run by campaign professionals as they are expected to be. But then there's not a lot of you lose more disclosure, you lose the transparency, you lose the connection between the candidate who's willing, who has to put their face on mm-hmm. on it, and that third-party PAC that they're depending on in order to fund very expensive campaigning in a state like California.
There's a question here that if we do control through legislation or require disclosure by super PACs, will the money simply go into a different kind of entity and we're always going to be, the law is always going to be one step behind.
I would say, and you might want to ask Susan Kennedy about this, I've never run a campaign, but I would say that people are very creative in that business.
Money is water.
Yes.
Goes around all
there's
obstacles.
There's
goes
always going to be. Right.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to do it. And it's the importance of getting this information. I kind of disagree. Yes, I think that the information should perhaps be provided to the Secretary of State immediately once the money is contributed or deposited. But we have to think about disclosure in a way that's effective for the public. I mean, it's not just to, you know, have all this information out there in the ether that people can't readily access and use in a thoughtful way. It has to be meaningful disclosure.
True, but that's what the media is for. The media has to have access, right. And that's what we count on the media to do, is to look at the donations, connect the dots, draw connections between campaign contributors and policies, or, you know.
It's complicated. Even the media, they want it served up to them.
Well, I tell you, when they used to have to come up and get it hard copy on the fourth floor, and then we went to the technology that we currently have up in Sacramento that have been there a number of years now. They were very happy.
And forgot about that.
And as soon as that system went down for 5 minutes, they were very unhappy.
Right.
So not only are they the ones that use it for the disclosure for the public, but they're also the ones that keep the pressure on the process, whether it be the legislature or the Secretary of State. And I'll tell you, when that system goes down, you knew about it.
You haven't lived.
Then it was like you're hiding something. You know, and once you got them used to not coming up and getting the hard copy, once they weren't going to come back and go back to that system. So I think it's, as you know, now you have a lot of other technologies that you have access to. And I think Susan's point is well taken. I mean, I've raised millions of dollars over 25 years in public life. And today, with the technology, it is possible to do that and to have that information there immediately. There is no substitute to make your job easier and the public's job simpler to make a decision than knowing where the funds are coming from. That's why this, and independent expenditures in California, you have to disclose. I mean, they have to disclose. There's a time period on it, but at least you know prior to the election. And that's one of the reasons why the super PAC is such a big issue, because it does totally go around this whole discussion we're having, and I don't think it's helpful to the process. And consequently, it does get to the point of, as Susan said, what is dirty campaigning? It's truth versus non-truth. And you may say, well, truth's in the eye of the beholder. But I'll tell you something. If you put your name on it, as we all know, you got a little different standard than if somebody over here is saying something that you can say, well, I didn't have anything to do with that. It's a wholly different situation. And the candidate has to be ultimately responsible for what they do and it's said.
Let me just remind our radio and television audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guests are Ann Ravel, who is chair of the California Fair Political Practices Commission, Bill Jones, who's former California Secretary of State and former Republican leader in the California State Assembly, and Susan Kennedy, former Chief of Staff to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and former Executive Director of the California Democratic Party. I'm Professor Kirk Hansen, Santa Clara University, and this program is on how to reduce dirty politics and improve the electoral process. Let me focus back on the role of the media, because we had several questions on that. Bill indicated that what's changed to some extent is the 24-hour news cycle, and that applied certain pressures. And yet at the same time, you praised the multiple debates, which were brokered by the media also, and constant appearances. The media seems to cut both ways.
No question. The benefit of the debates are that at least the public, whether you agree with the questions or not, at least the public gets to see the candidates firsthand, and the candidate gets to talk right to the public. Now, the other issue, though, with the 24-hour news cycle, I mean, I've done hardball. I mean, I've done host of the talk shows over the years, I'm sure others have. And there is a certain need in those shows to generate some controversy. There is the impression, and probably rightly so, that if you're going to sit there and everybody agrees, everybody in the audience is going to go to sleep. And so if you're competing now with so many channels, then the competition between those shows, whether one's a right or one's a left, it all just gets ginned up. And then the candidate or the legislator or congressperson becomes really the fodder for the process. I mean, it's no longer about oftentimes the policy. It's about the ratings that they can generate, and you invite the people on that will get you the ratings. So it cuts both ways, to answer your question. It has a positive, and it's necessary, and I think that's great. And heaven knows we wouldn't be able to get by unless it was out there. But on the other hand, it has changed a great deal over the last 20 years with the advent of all this new technology.
Mm-hmm. Susan, did the media help or hinder real governing during your time in the governor's office?
It depends on whether you were trying to use it or not, or on the receiving end of it. I think I'm joking. It always helped. I mean, you had to understand it. It's like a wave, and if it's coming, whether you're paying attention to it or not. And so, if you don't respect it, then it can really hurt you. But there's, I think that it's the social media that we're blending together in this that I think it needs to be separated out a little bit. The advent of Facebook and Twitter and instant quotes on your BlackBerry make it. It can either be a very powerful tool that we used while governing. Mm-hmm. So, there's a vote happening. It's 11 o'clock at night. We're a long session. You get information to the right blogger or the right editorial writer, and they post something, and you send that around on the floor of the, we've influenced votes that we needed. We've also had in negotiations break down literally in an instant because some blogger posted a nasty post, and it scared half the legislature. So that's not the media as much as it's the social, the instant media, the social media. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a force to be reckoned with, and sometimes it helps, and sometimes it's very painful.
And we've had a couple of questions about another area of FPBC responsibility, which is lobbyist regulation. And do you have any thoughts about increased scrutiny of lobbyists? Has the role of lobbyists changed? Do they contribute to this environment of lack of trust that you're concerned about?
I probably am not the best person to answer that question. It might be a better question, actually, for someone who was in the legislature or in the governor's office. But I think that there's a debate about the role of lobbyists. And in many cases, because of the turnover of the legislature in California because of term limits, for a number of other reasons, lobbyists have a very important role because they know the subject matter. And often the legislators perhaps don't, and you could speak to that more. And there's a question. There's recently a book by Professor Lessig about the influence of lobbyists, and that it isn't so much the money, it is the relationships that are built with lobbyists. I mean, from the point of view of the FPPC, it's very difficult for lobbyists to provide money to the legislature. There is a $10 a month limitation on gifts with a maximum of $50, a year. So it's very, and they cannot contribute to their campaigns. So lobbyists from the FPPC point of view do not have an outsized influence.
Any different perspective on part of Susan, your experience in the governor's office?
Lobbyists are doing their job. And we've given them a greater role in the process, an unhealthy role in the process, mm-hmm. by term limits. I voted for term limits. I supported term limits. And now I think it's the one of the worst things we could have done, because we've actually created a legion of lobbyists and staff in the legislature who are far more sophisticated than anyone elected to office, because they don't have time to become sophisticated on the process. We've empowered the lobbyists. They're doing their job. And we complain we don't like the lobbyists because they're dirty, we don't like the PACs because they're dirty, we don't like the campaign money because that's dirty. It would be very nice if we just had the public and everyone in the public, the business, everybody just sit back and not participate and let people do their job. I know, that would be really nice. But the fact is, this legislature in California passes more than 1,000 bills a year, everything from where you can walk your dog to what kind of car you can drive to whether or not your business is going to survive this year or move to another state. So people have to be involved in the process. We need lobbyists. We need people influencing who gets elected to office. That is the democratic process, as ugly and dirty as it is. We need transparency, and we need strong watchdogs to make sure cheating is kept to a minimum.
I'd be interested in, Bill, your attitude towards term limits.
I defended term limits and won that case at the U.S. Supreme Court, so that's the reason you still have term limits. I wasn't necessarily a proponent of that, because my strong belief was if we didn't have fair reapportionments, you wouldn't get fair representative districts, and then both parties couldn't win and lose. So really what created term limits was the 82 reapportionment.
Yes.
That was done by Governor Brown at the time. That was very much skewed one way. And then what we ended up with, by the time you got to the end of the 80s, people were so disgusted because there couldn't be any changes up or down. Everything was rigid that they went with term limits because they thought that was the only way they could fix it. So my position as Secretary of State, I always defended all the way everything the people passed. Whether I agreed with it or not didn't matter. If people passed it, I would extend whatever I needed to do to defend it, and I won that case. Having said that, going back to your question, I think what Susan said is right about this overall issue with lobbyists. When I first went to Sacramento in the early 80s, I made a point of going down the book and having lunch with most all of those folks. And what you find is there's probably not one person in this room that isn't represented by some group or entity in Sacramento making a case about something. And it is important. The cut to the chase on that, though, there's no way every legislator can know about every issue, and yet you're being asked to vote on a whole range of issues that you don't have the same expertise on as the ones you know from your district. So what you find out is which of the lobbyists can provide information that has helpful to making that decision and which ones won't. And over time, you kind of sort through that. And so the information is what you glean from that process. If you run into a problem and say, well, people are contributing and they're influencing legislation with money, that goes back to the character of the candidate or the incumbent. And you can chase these symptoms around all you want. But one, if you got to elect someone who you have confidence in and you believe in, and two, it would be very helpful in the current environment to have a fair reapportionment where both parties could win or lose any given cycle. If we had that, you would find that a lot of these other issues would go away. Unfortunately, both Republicans and Democrats work to try and skew the process every 10 years in their favor permanently. And that hurts California more than you can imagine.
I have to ask about this year's Citizens Commission for redistricting and whether you see that as a step forward or not. All three of you, I'd be interested in your views on that. Is that helping us reduce the partisanship that we see in state government?
You know, I've done four reapportionments, 80, 90, 2000, and now this one, which I was not involved with, but just from afar. And we will see at the end of the day how this sorts out in the election cycle, because it's really probably a little early to tell. But California is a candidate-driven state. It's not a party-driven state, no matter what people think. And if you have the opportunity for the candidates to be able to run on the issues with their party, but both parties be able to win or lose, then you generate that mix that really is good for the republic. So I hope the commission works. I think the one we did in 92... which the reapportionment opened up the process. We ended up with a Republican assembly for the first time in 25 years, and that was a good thing. And if we lose it because we don't have candidates, the Democrats win, that's fine. But at the end of the day, if this one-party rule is not good, and in many respects, it's not good either way, because what happens is that, you know, we're all human, and we have a tendency, if one party's doing it all their way all the time, their interest groups get too much power, the process gets arrogant, the public gets disgusted, and you get these swings. If you have that homogenization, if you have that energy from both parties winning and losing, that's what the system was designed to really give the best governance. And we haven't had that in a while, and I think that's part of the problem we've got now.
Susan Kennedy, is this a step forward, the Citizens Commission?
I think it's a huge step forward. It may not be the result everyone expected from the various party desires, but I think the combination of the redistricting that's done not by design to protect incumbents, but to represent those communities, and the open primary, the top two primary. It's the combination of those two things. They have to go together. I think you're going to see a lot more competition, because even in districts that are still safe Republican or safe Democrat, given the makeup of the community that's in the district, the top two primary is going to open up the possibility of putting together a majority of support from independents and from moderates of the other party. And so I think you have at least a chance of moderating the influence of special interests who can control the vote within their own party through the money spigot by the combination of those two things.
And Ravel, do you expect this is going to change the game, these two developments for the FPPC?
I don't know that it's going to really have an impact on what we do. I'd just like to comment kind of quickly, though, what I think was so amazing about the redistricting commission process was all the public meetings, all the input, all the concern about making sure that communities are that are consistent communities be kept together. That was so new for California and really an impressive feat.
There are a couple of questions about how California compares to the rest of the United States. Is our politics dirtier in California or cleaner? There's actually one question. Which do you consider the dirtiest state in the country? But I won't force your answering that question. How does California compare in terms of the politics, the stridency, and so on?
California is far and away the most entertaining state in the country, without question. But we've got lots of company on the dirtiest of our campaigns.
Mm-hmm. I would say that California has far fewer scandals in the political arena, at least from our perspective, than most states in the country.
Fewer frauds, less conflict of interest problem.
Yes, no question about it.
Why?
Potentially it's because we have had a watchdog for so many years, mm-hmm. that's been relatively effective, but that's what I get together with my fellow ethics people throughout the country. I think we're in much better stead.
I think I would agree with that.
That it's been our tradition,
and it's been since after 74 with the
right.
And the initiatives that your predecessor Ross Johnson and others carried in the late 70s to add additional clarification and authorization for actual teeth in the Fair Political Practices actions made a big difference. And over time, it's helped. And so I would agree pretty much with what Ann said.
There are a couple of questions about trust and what you really think builds the public's trust in the electoral process and in the governing process. You've made reference to several things. One is that some districts are competitive, and that builds some trust. What else is there that what are people going to say, hopefully in November of this year, that was a pretty good election season. I have more trust now in government than I did before.
Well, I hope what Susan said comes to pass, that the top two and also the reapportionment commission does generate some benefits that we haven't seen before. We'll see. I don't know on that. With respect to the issues, the inability of the legislature to grasp these major issues is a huge problem. And I served back at a time before term limits, and I served with people on both sides of the aisle that were very knowledgeable about the issues. And we disagreed on a lot of things most of the time. However, for the most part, even, my good friend John Burton, who you all know from up here, would from time to time harass me and berate me on the floor of the Assembly when I was Republican leader and Speaker Willie Brown was Speaker. We'd walk off the floor and he'd say, let's go have lunch. I mean, you have to have the relationships. You can fight, and the Speaker and I, I have respect for his abilities. I don't agree with him on a great deal of things, but he was very talented from the standpoint of being able to move the process forward to some kind of a conclusion. And when it would loggerhead, I always had the benefit of serving, for the most part, with a governor of my same party. So even though we were in the minority, the governor was in the same party. So you get that balance, that leverage back and forth to generate some conclusion. So, and I think for the most part, too, there was an awful lot of, back then, of members who had been around a while. The governors I served with under as Republicans had been legislators for a long period of time. It takes a different set of skills to be a legislator than it does to be an executor in the state government, and it's oftentimes very difficult to have someone that has both those skills. But if you have governors who have been legislators, then it's easier for them to bring people together oftentimes to reach an accommodation. I can't speak for the current environment, haven't been up there in the legislature since 94, so I'm pretty dated. But this is where the confidence, though, you mentioned about the confidence of the public. They expect the legislature to solve the problems, even if they don't agree with the solutions. And that is the crisis of confidence that you see. And it's unfortunate that that's the case. Hopefully that will get better, and maybe the changes Susan mentioned and the disclosure Ann has talked about will accomplish that.
Mm-hmm. Have anything more to add?
Just to sort of reiterate, I think trust does come from disclosure. I mean, we've talked a lot about disclosure and what it does, but if people know who's funding either a measure or a candidate or who else is contributing to them in some way, it goes a long way to making them feel confident. If they don't know, that's when they start to feel that people are cheating or not being honest with them.
Mm-hmm. And the strong language, the accusations of that perhaps are in the extreme about the motives of the other party or whatever, which have become more common when you don't have the personal relationship.
Well, I mean, there was strong language oftentimes when I mean, that is not necessarily something new.
Okay.
And I think it is, to some degree, the strength of a person's conviction. Sometimes they get carried away, just like they do normally. Mm-hmm. However, in 14 years that I served in the legislature, I don't ever remember anyone in the House that on any given day I couldn't go up to and have a conversation with, mm-hmm. of either party. And so I think, as Susan said, it's more challenging when you're there for a shorter period and the turnover is greater, and I would agree with that. But by the same token, the other side of that is it's kind of like a platoon in the Army. If you know you're in the platoon and you're not going to get transferred out, what do? You better make sure that you know all these people, because you're going to have to live with them. And so it is a part of the process. But today it is very much more difficult because the sides have gotten hardened. And that's where the action is. And so it is hard to do that. And oftentimes, I know, people are criticized for doing that and, talking and working with the other side. And, again, you have to have very strong beliefs. You have to represent your principles, your district and all. But at the end of the day, you're never going to get it all your way. And I think that is one of the issues that is very difficult to deal with today.
We have just a couple of moments more. I'd like to ask each of you what you're going to do between now and November to try to help change the tenor and the tone. of this election or what you hope will be done. Ann, as chair of the FPPC, what do you hope to do between now and November?
Well, for one thing, I think that the control and regulation of super PACs, independent expenditures, while we have a fairly good system, it's not enough. And some of that we can do at the FPPC, and we're looking at that right now. But some of it will require legislation to hold people accountable, mm-hmm. where we now have no ability to do that. And so we're pursuing legislation and hoping for everybody's support in that mm-hmm. to do something about super PACs. And the other thing has to do with disclosure, which I think is important. And I agree it would be nice to do 24-hour. But honestly, you did a wonderful system, Mr. Jones, but it's antiquated. It's very antiquated.
I know the feeling.
And no, and, you know, no matter how much data is out there, it needs to be presented in a way that people can access it. And it's just scandalous that we don't have an ability to do that, to provide that kind of information to people in this state. And I'm working with, in fact, I'd like to point out Dan Newman, who's from MapLight, who's a fellow interested in giving information to the public. We are working with nonprofits mm-hmm. to try to bolster the system.
Susan, if I may, you're the most recent out of governing. What do you hope will happen in this election that might make things better than perhaps they've
been?
Oh,
that's a different question. I was prepared. You said, what was I going to do?
Yes, please, go right ahead.
I'm going to say nothing untrue about any candidate between now and November. I think if you don't like the rhetoric, turn off the TV. You know, mm-hmm. get over it. Politics is hard. And don't reward people who offend you with your vote. Mm-hmm. But other than that, politics is a hard ball game, and we should just either enjoy it or turn off the TV and vote anyway.
Thank you. Bill, what would you like to see happen, or what are you going to do yourself to try to help?
Well, I hope that Ann has success in what she's trying to do. Clearly, when we started and built that system, that antiquated system, 15 years ago, we didn't have resources either. We went to the Silicon Valley, and we said, look, you help us build this. We only have so much, and then if it works, you can go sell it to other states. So the people in California don't care about making money off that. They're happy just to have the system so that we can use it ourselves. So there are ways to fund those things, and we were talking about it earlier, like you're doing with nonprofits. But I think that if we're successful, then I would hope that the turnouts go up. You know, as Secretary of State, our goal was always 100% participation, zero tolerance for voter fraud, if mm-hmm. we could get that. If there's an energized constituency and a tough election, tough elections, while they may be perceived to be, quote, you call them, you say dirty or whatever, the energy generates turnout. And so what I would hope is that the people all vote, regardless whether they're happy or not with the candidates. It is an obligation of the people of this country to step up and make a decision, just like if you're a legislator, you have to do that. And I would hope I could do something toward that end, even in my retired capacity, to encourage all Californians to get out and vote.
I think probably then you wouldn't agree with one of the questions I didn't get to ask, which was, should we replace all legislators with a plebiscite process online? So, all right. I want to thank our panelists this evening, Ann Ravel, who is the chair of the California Fair Political Practices Commission, Bill Jones, former California Secretary of State and former Republican leader of the California State Assembly, and Susan Kennedy, former chief of staff to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and former executive director of the California Democratic Party. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's high-profile series on ethics and accountability, underwritten by the Charles Traverse family. I'm Professor Kirk Hansen of Santa Clara University. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.